Good afternoon, everyone. Good morning for those of you further west, and good evening for those of you further east. My name is Professor Chris Alden. I'm co-director of LSE Ideas. We're here to discuss, of course, the book and the area of Central Asia more generally that recently released. Sino-Stand, China's Inadvertent Empire by Raffaello Pantucci and his late co-author Alexandros Peterson. Before we begin and go through formal introductions, I just want to say a little bit about what we're hoping to do today. This is a China Foresight event. What our general, which is a project within LSE Ideas, what our general hope where China Foresight is to bring attention to some of the subtleties of the China role as a global actor, some issues with respect to its domestic environment, the role of personalities, institutions, its engagement bilaterally and multilaterally. And it was in that spirit that we thought that a discussion about Central Asia with respect to China is important. In fact, we think that it provides a vision of how China will be engaged with, engages in, and will be engaged in international affairs more generally. So cradle of the Belt Road Initiative, a region that is emblematic of China's wider concept of globalization and in its many manifestations, economic, diplomatic, cultural, and security. And in fact, despite that very central position in territorial, geographic, and since the Belt Road Initiative, certainly economic outreach, we have a dearth of understanding of China's presence in Central Asia. So this is an opportunity for us to examine a region that has been that extends from flashpoints in Afghanistan in a certain period to the outer reaches of Kyrgyzstan and everywhere in between. What are China's objectives in Central Asia? How will the coming events shape and inform China's declared unlimited partnership with Moscow, given that this is a region that historically has had a very strong imprint? In any case, we're very pleased to have Raffaello Pantucci speak to us today about Sino-Stan and China's Inadvertent Empire. He's a senior associate fellow at RUSI, also holds an associate fellow post at Rajaratnam School of International Studies in Singapore. He will be speaking at length about the book, and then we will have some discussions thereafter. Our commentator, Dr. Teresa Fallon, director for the Center for Russia, Europe, Asia Studies, due to a travel problem, is at the moment not ready to join us. We certainly hope she will. But in any case, we're going to have a lively discussion irrespective. So I'm going to hand it over to Raffaello.
Thank you very much, Professor Alden, and thank you to your colleagues at LSE Ideas for kindly inviting me to come and speak about Sino-Stan, a book I've been working on for some time. I'm now going to try the magical trick of getting some slides working, and we will discover if I am technically proficient or not. I believe I am sharing slides now. I would appreciate if someone could... can you see? You can see them. Good. I saw a thumbs up there, so I'm going to assume that's a good to go. So thank you again. It's wonderful to join you and to talk about the book and to talk about more generally China's relations with Central Asia. The book is one that I have co-authored with a very good colleague of mine, Alexandros Peterson, who was sadly killed murdered in Kabul about 4 or 5 years ago now. He sadly, after passing away, it was a project we started working on together over a decade ago. And after doing all the research and work, I ended up being sadly the only one to be able to carry it over the line. But the book was basically founded on the idea of trying to understand China's relations with Central Asia. Both myself and Alex were inveterate enjoyers of traveling around Central Asia and traveling around Eurasia more generally. And we enjoyed going to see this part of the world. And one of the things we discovered as we traveled around it was how it was really changing. And it was changing because China was becoming an increasingly influential player in this region. Now, I'm now going to get you onto the next slide to show you a map of what we're actually talking about here. So the book is basically based on over a decade's research and travel, basically around the 5 countries of Central Asia and Afghanistan and Xinjiang in China. And you can see here on a map that these regions are all very adjacent, all very close. And what I think we found when we first started traveling out to Xinjiang was that if we tried to understand Xinjiang, we discovered that it really was very similar in many ways to the 5 Central Asian countries that it was adjacent to. And it was also had links and deep connections to Afghanistan, the 6th Central Asian country, which it kind of sits next to. So the research for the book is basically drawn off over a decade's travel and research around all 7 of these countries, really, and actually further afield. We met experts in Pakistan, in India, in Iran, in Russia, who all sort of looked at this region. And the idea was really to try to understand what was changing and what was changing on the ground. And our key sort of takeaway, which is captured in the sort of subheading of China's inadvertent empire, is this idea that you have a part of the world, which if we read our Mackinder, is the part of the world that sort of dominates the world island, and therefore, you know, the entire Eurasian landmass, and therefore the kind of planet, is a part of the world where China is really becoming the most consequential actor, where Russia used to be the kind of dominant player, and Russia does still have a very strong sort of hand, but China is clearly the coming force, and the coming force that is coming in a way that in many ways Beijing hasn't really thought about the consequences of. And this was kind of one of the fundamental theses that we tried to get out in the book. This idea that China is clearly becoming the kind of the most influential and powerful player in this part of the world, but it's a player that doesn't care about this part of the world and is just sort of becoming the dominant player here in many ways incidentally. And so we're trying to think through what the consequences of having this large superpower, this sort of second largest power or most influential power on the world stage, become such a dominant player here. So that was really the foundation of the book. And that's the idea of this idea of Sino-San, China's inadvertent empire. It's this area which China is clearly becoming the most consequential actor, but where China doesn't appear to be trying to exert much energy and actually trying to do something about resolving the many problems that do exist on the ground. Now, one of the first things we found as we traveled around the region was that, of course, China's relations with Central Asia go back a very long way. When we started doing the work on this project, which was really 2010, 2011, you know, this is before Belt and Road. This is before everyone's really thinking about the march westward, as it was later articulated by Professor Wang Jisi, the Dean of International Studies at Peking University, who famously in 2012 wrote this article, Marching Westward, which was a sort of peon for China to stop focusing so much on the Pacific and focusing on its relationship with the United States, and instead to look inward across its western borders, where there was this incredibly rich and, you know, important territory where it wasn't really paying attention, and where China was still very intimately bound to through borders, through, you know, civilizational relations, and also through ethnic relations. It's important to remember when we think of Xinjiang in China, we always think of the Uyghur community, and we think of it as a majority Chinese based community, and it is, but there are substantial diasporas, many hundreds of thousands, if not millions, based in Central Asia. And similarly, there are, you know, many Central Asians, Kazakhs, Kyrgyz, and Uyghurs, Kazakhs, Kyrgyz, and Tajiks, sorry, who actually live in China. So you've got a sort of region which is very much tied to its neighborhood, not just a kind of traditionally, typically ethnic Han Chinese part of the world. And so this means that China's always had an interest in this part of the world. And I think two interesting markers that I would ask you to look back at, you know, which go back to the sort of post-Cold War period, which is at the end of the Cold War, you know, China was left with suddenly sharing a border to its west, not only with one large powered Soviet Union, but actually with four different countries, or five, if we include Mongolia. But in Central Asia in particular, suddenly China had to deal with not only having borders with Russia, but also with Kazakhstan, with Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan. And this precipitated the creation of the Shanghai Six organization, which is essentially an entity which brought together the leaders of the, you know, China and the newly created Soviet republics, the formerly Soviet republics, to essentially start to delineate their borders. These borders had always been quite fuzzy. And what we saw happen at the end of the Cold War was the decision to try to formalize them. And these were formalized in two ways. On the one hand, we saw the creation of something called the Shanghai Six, which is essentially this border delineation entity, which later developed into the Shanghai Cooperation Organization when it was joined by Uzbekistan, a Central Asian country that doesn't share a border with China, but was very much born at the same time. But also, we saw in 1994, Premier Li Peng went on a tour of the region. And this was a tour of a region which in many ways shadowed the earlier 1992 tour of the coasts done by Deng Xiaoping, when he visited China's coastal cities to open them up to the world, to show that this part of the world was really opening up and China was changing from what it was before. Li Peng, in many ways, his tour to the to China's west was a sort of echo of that. In 1994, he visited all four of the Central Asian capitals. He left out Dushanbe, which at the time was racked by civil war, but he also visited Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia. And during this visit, he very clearly articulated two kind of key requests at all the stops. Number one was a concern about separatists and Uyghurs in particular. China recognized that there were large Uyghur diasporas that exist in Central Asian countries, and these were communities that could cause potential problems for China, and had in fact caused instances of incivility that China saw, where it saw these groups to cross the borders, instigating trouble within China's borders. But then the second request was to basically try to recreate the Silk Roads of the past. But at the time, the idea of recreating Silk Roads wasn't what we think of now when we think of Silk Roads, which is essentially routes that start in China emanating out towards Europe or across the oceans elsewhere in the under the rubric of the Maritime Silk Road. At the time, the idea of Silk Roads is much more about getting China, Central Asia's mineral resources across China, ultimately to Japan, to the big booming economies of the East. China, of course, at the time was a country which was still in a very much more developmental phase, but it saw an opportunity here of creating these sorts of routes. And so at the time, the requests were twofold. One, worry about separatists, Uyghurs in particular, and two, Silk Roads, but Silk Roads in a different direction to how we conceptualize them now. But I think what's important to take away from this is that the idea of worrying about security and its links to Central Asia, and on the other hand, worrying about the idea of Silk Roads in Central Asia having some important connection to China, neither of these are new ideas. And they're ones that China's been thinking about since these countries really achieved their independence at the end of the Cold War. The creation of the SCO is another element I'll briefly linger on for a second, which was, of course, as I say, born out of this border delineation outfit, which initially, you know, the different powers that joined it for many different reasons. So the Central Asians at the time were trying to define their sense of nationhood and thought, well, you know, an international organization that we can join on our own terms as members of our own standing is something we want to participate in. But Russia saw it instead much more dismissively. And actually, in the early iterations of the sort of heads of state meeting, Premier Jiang Zemin had to specifically reach out to Boris Yeltsin to lobby him to attend the sessions, because Boris Yeltsin's tendency was to dismiss the entity and say, well, it's very important to us. You know, we'll send someone like, you know, Evgeny Primakov or some other senior figure to go attend on our behalf, because, you know, this is basically something the Chinese are interested in and we don't really care about. But the other interesting thing to think about with the SCO was that the SCO at the time, everyone joined it for different reasons. So when China created it and China pushed forwards the idea of creating first the Shanghai Six and then the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the idea was very much one to give China an umbrella to engage with this region. But the region, of course, saw it very differently. As I say, the countries of Central Asia saw it as a joint opportunity to join international organization, and the Russians saw it as a way of, you know, essentially trying to control Chinese efforts in the region. But the one thing that they all unified around was terrorism. And this is why counterterrorism becomes a fundamental thing that really ties the SCO region together. Because when they're thinking about terrorists, all of the members of the SCO could broadly agree on what it was that they all thought was, you know, a terrorist looked like, and therefore it was something they could easily get together and agree on. And of course, in 2001, while this organization was founded in June of that year, in September, of course, we saw the shocking attacks of September 11th on the United States emanating from Afghanistan, a country of great concern to all of the SCO member states, in part because many of them shared a border with it. So this kind of gives you the foundation in some ways of the research and the thinking that we're doing, which is understanding China's relations with this part of the world. And then I think we have to track forward to 2009, where I think we get the next big fundamental pivot point, if you will, in China's interests in Central Asia. And that was expressed here in this photo on the left of your screens, where we have the rioting that took place in Urumqi in July 2009, when widespread protests in the region from angry Uyghurs living in the region escalating to violence and led to counter protests by Han the next day and potential violence across the region, and led to over 200 deaths in the sort of protesting rioting that occurred as a result. And this is an important event for China and its engagement with Xinjiang, because this event was so, the protest became so out of hand that then Premier Hu Jintao had to leave an international G8 summit at L'Aquila, Italy, and go back home to essentially manage some domestic riots, which is sort of a very humiliating moment for the Chinese leadership. This is their moment to kind of shine on the world stage, show they were a great power along with the other G8 economies at the time to sort of, you know, strut on the world stage in Italy. And suddenly they were pulled back by essentially a domestic protest trouble between a minority and the majority community out in Xinjiang. And this created a realization that what had been going on in Xinjiang until then was essentially not managing the situation effectively. And the longstanding tensions that you had between the Uyghur minorities and the Han increasing community in the region was actually leading to a growing violent situation. And so the response from China's perspective was twofold. On the one hand, there was a heavy security crackdown that we can still see to this day. But on the other hand, there's a realization, I think, that in the longer term, if you're going to deal with the problems that was underpinning the violence that they saw in July 2009, you are not only going to have to put a very heavy security clamp on this, but you are also going to have to create some sort of different economic context and open the region up economically to ensure that it was actually that everyone in the region would become rich, prosperous and happy, and therefore not want to rebel against the state in this sort of a way. And so you see a big economic push as well, an economic push that goes in all sorts of directions, in terms of massive economic investment from the center, in terms of pressure on companies that were operating in Xinjiang, extractive companies like CNPC, to actually spend more of their profits in the region rather than sending them back to Beijing, to some of the richer provinces in Shanghai or Guangzhou or Guangdong to send more of their money and their cadres out to the region to help the region grow and develop. The realization they quickly came to, I think, was that not only, you know, would you have to invest in the region, but you'd actually have to invest in the region around it. Because Xinjiang is in many ways as landlocked as the five Central Asian or three Central Asian countries it shares borders with. You know, so while Uzbekistan proudly calls itself, you know, the one of the world's only two double landlocked countries, and I'll let viewers guess what the other one is. You know, the point is these countries are very far from any oceans, and very far from any clear logistics chain. So if Xinjiang is really going to start to become a trading hub, it's going to have to develop some sort of infrastructure with the region around it to be able to prosper. And in this becomes the kind of foundation of the Belt and Road Initiative. But at the time, it's not articulated like that. It's much more about, well, we're trying to bring prosperity to this region, so we have to increase the economic connectivity that goes out from this region into Central Asia and beyond, which is going to involve infrastructure investment. It's going to involve development and opening of markets and development and opening of roads and routes and rail and all sorts of other ways of transporting goods and products around the world. And so this then becomes what later in 2013 becomes articulated by Xi Jinping as the Silk Road Economic Belt. And we see him here on the right giving his speech at Nazarbayev University in what was then called Astana, but is now called Nur-Sultan in Kazakhstan, the first of two speeches, which were the inauguration of the Belt and Road Initiative. Here he spoke in Kazakhstan about the Silk Road Economic Belt, which built on what had been happening since 2009, which was basically an attempt to open Xinjiang up to its neighborhood and ultimately open Xinjiang up to the world. But then after that, a month later, he goes to Jakarta and gives a similar speech at the parliament there, where he talks about the creation of the 21st century maritime Silk Road. And we get the two strands of the Belt and Road Initiative. But what was happening in Central Asia had been happening already for at least the 5 years since the protests in Xinjiang. But in fact, you could even find trace of it even before in what Li Peng had been talking about in 1994. And so in many ways, what we see is the Belt and Road Initiative is stamping a label on something that had been happening already in Central Asia for some time, and then globalizing it, recognizing that what was happening in Central Asia was in some way something that Beijing could understand and control, about opening up markets, about sending companies to build infrastructure, about extending loans to then help these companies to go there, to help China develop, but also to help the region develop, to ultimately help bring greater prosperity to China. And so in some ways, what we think about as the Belt and Road was something that was born out of this region that was basically putting an imprimatur, well, Xi Jinping putting his own personal imprimatur on something that had been happening for many years before. But I think the important thing to remember when we're thinking about the kind of BRI in general is that, and this is something we found firsthand in traveling around the region, is that it wasn't just a story of extractives. You know, people tended to think about BRI in Central Asia. They always think about the oil fields of Kazakhstan, the gas fields of Turkmenistan, some of the rich mineral deposits you find in Tajikistan or Kyrgyzstan. In fact, what we found was this was really investment across the board. And it was Chinese companies becoming engaged in, you know, here on the left, on the far left, you have a CBRC campsite we found on the roads in Kyrgyzstan, which we walked right into. As you can see, the gate was wide open. We wandered straight in there, and these were the guys who were building the roads to repurpose the roads to get to the border guard, the border post in Irkutsk and Torogurt in Kyrgyzstan. You know, this is a company that was very much building this, and you know, it was interesting at the time when we talked to the workers there, they all thought that their colleagues in other parts of the world had a much better deal than them, even though they were so close to China. To CNPC, Sinopec, as you can see here, selling its energy petrol in Kazakhstan. The point there was that we noticed that not only was it a case of Chinese companies seeking to extract oil and gas from the region, but actually investing quite heavily in the broader energy infrastructure of the region. And this is in terms of helping refurbish, you know, gas meters in Uzbekistan, to helping rebuild solar furnaces in the region, to pumping gas and selling gas in the region. And then on the bottom, if we look at Huawei, which alongside ZTE, the other big Chinese technology giant, was essentially building all of the hardware in the region. And at the time when we started doing this, it was still very much a story of mostly Chinese hardware and Russian software. But what we noticed on some of our more recent visits to the region was actually it's a story of Chinese software increasingly as well. And companies like Alibaba increasingly dominating the local markets and actually taking over in some ways from the kind of shuttle trade that you used to see going back and forth between China's markets and Central Asia. But then also it was a story of soft power. And this, you know, we had the good advantage and good fortune of visiting, I think, pretty much all of or most of the Confucius Institutes in Central Asia at the time. And what was interesting there was that, you know, when we went around and talked to the many students that we would find was, you know, not many of them actually were interested in studying Confucius or learning about, you know, Sun Tzu or learning, you know, China in its sort of culture and history. They were interested in China because it was a trading opportunity. And they saw that there was a great opportunity to be had there. And we noticed that when we talked to sort of a lot of middle-class families, we found that growing numbers of them were interested in sending their children to China to study. You know, they would love to go to American universities, British universities, but they were very expensive. They were very far away. And Chinese universities offered scholarships, very good scholarships, that would, you know, cover their costs and get them to go to China and ultimately help their children learn a language and develop a relationship with the culture, which was clearly going to be very important to Central Asia going forwards. But it was very interesting to see this and to observe how China was sort of increasingly building the next generations of young people in these communities. The other thing I briefly linger on is the photo you'll see there up on the top right of the 11th Chinese Bridge Competition in Tashkent. The young woman smiling out of the camera for us was this very smart young Uzbek girl who we met, whose Mandarin was infinitely better than mine. She spent a lot of time correcting me when I was speaking Chinese to them. She, you know, when we asked her, well, what do you want to do when you grow up and why are you learning Mandarin? She wanted to become a TV presenter on CCTV. She thought this is the pinnacle of achievement. She noticed CCTV was being broadcast in Uzbekistan. She thought, well, they would need some Uzbek presenters. And so she would do that job. And Last I met her was many years later in Shanghai, and I think she was well on her way, but I haven't actually seen her on CCTV yet. But I think, you know, the point being that you have got this kind of pull towards China that is growing and creating a real magnetism towards this region that's pulling it in some ways away from Russia. And then to briefly touch on security, which is, you know, an issue that people will talk about a lot with Central Asia, and particularly this will kind of bring us over to the Russia discussion a bit, because I think people traditionally, when they think about China's relations with Central Asia, they tend to think about it in that, you know, China does the economics and Russia does the security. And this is kind of an odd construction from our perspective, because why does that make any sense? I mean, we understand that Russia has a kind of more paternalistic view of this part of the world, seeing it as, you know, its former vassal states. But at the same time, security tends to cost money. And, you know, we didn't imagine that Chinese companies were eager to just sort of abrogate their security interests to someone else. They would want to be worried about them themselves. But what we also noticed was that China, when it worried about security interests in the region, it worried about them through a very narrow lens. And that narrow lens was focused on really one thing, which was its own domestic security. And that articulated itself in two ways. On the one hand, it was, and here I would point you to the picture you can see of the Chinese and the Tajik soldiers marching proudly along their border, brandishing their flags. On the Chinese side, the critical thing to remember is that these are PAP, People's Armed Police, rather than PLA forces. So these are forces who within China are focused very much on domestic security concerns. They're focused on counterterrorism. They're focused on those issues rather than, you know, the expansive vision of the PLA as a sort of army that goes and invades abroad. And it's the PAP, when we looked into it, that's really been at the forefront of engaging in Central Asia. It's the PAP that's led a lot of the bilateral engagements, that's done a lot of the sort of bilateral trainings, and that has built bases in Tajikistan to help them have oversight and a view, frankly, on what is going on in Afghanistan, which is where they see the greatest potential source of instability in some ways towards them in the region. And what is China's concerns about stability there? Well, it's still very much focused on militant Uyghurs. There have been instances in Central Asia where militant Uyghurs have attacked and killed Chinese nationals. In Kyrgyzstan, this has happened a number of times back in the late 90s, early 2000s, and more recently in 2016, where a suicide car bomber blew himself up at the Chinese embassy in Bishkek. And those militants tend to be associated, at least in Chinese conception, often it's very difficult to ascertain the degree to which they are, with the group that you can see at the bottom in a still from a video from the Turkestan Islamic Party, an organization that that is, you know, that is tradition, the Chinese tend to refer to as the East Turkestan Islamic Movement, but calls itself the Turkestan Islamic Party, the Hizbul Islamic Turkestani. But this organization, it does exist at the moment, as far as we can tell. It has a presence in Afghanistan, quite limited, much more substantial presence in Syria. But it is a driving concern that continues to emanate towards Chinese interests. Now, Chinese security concerns have expanded beyond this now, and they're much more worried about militants in general attacking them. But in Central Asia, it still seems to be mostly a story of Uyghurs that they're mostly worried about. The story of bigger militant groups focusing on China tends to be in Pakistan, and I'd be happy to talk about that if people are interested, but it kind of falls slightly outside the scope of this book. But again, I've done a lot of work on it, so I'd be happy to return to that. And briefly now, because I'm conscious I've slightly gone over time, but I've taken advantage of the fact that Teresa is sadly unable to join us so far to maybe chew in a little bit to her time. So forgive me, LSE colleagues, in advance. But, you know, the final points I wanted to leave with you was basically some thoughts about Afghanistan and Russia, because they are both quite current. And I think the key thing I'd point to here is that, you know, China's relations with the Taliban is something that we touched on a lot in the book, and we did some research on, talked to a lot of people about. But it's an interesting one, because I think from a Chinese perspective, you know, I think what's interesting to look at is, well, we've seen the Chinese have engaged very heavily with the Taliban recently, and this builds on quite a long history of engagement that goes back pre-9/11. The Chinese were very comfortable with the Republic government when it was in charge. And in many ways, they saw it as a more stable creation than the Taliban government that they have now. And while we see them now engaging the Taliban very actively, they're doing that, I think, in large part because they recognize that no one else really is. And there's a real possibility that this state might completely fall apart. And they recognize that if that happens, it will have potential repercussions to them because they share a direct border, but will undoubtedly have repercussions in Central Asia and Pakistan, regions with which they have much larger borders and where they are, frankly, not entirely confident in the capabilities of the local government to deliver absolute security. So, you know, the engagement the Chinese have been doing with the Taliban is something that, you know, it's interesting in many ways. I think it's a hedge that they've continued for a very long time, where they are engaging, but they're not overcommitting and they're not really putting all their eggs in one basket. They are still leaving a little bit behind in case this all falls apart and they need to engage with someone else. But the flip to that is, I would point out that, you know, the Republic government was very happy to engage with the Chinese, and they did, even though the Americans had a pretty terrible relationship with them. And actually, Afghanistan was one of the few places where you could find the Americans and the Chinese actively cooperating together on security goals. But actually, what's interesting is that's flipped quite tightly with the Taliban, who have quite seamlessly been engaging with a government that until recently was actively engaging with their main enemy, the Republic government in Kabul. And then to flip over to Russia, because that, I think, brings us right up to date with events in Ukraine. You know, this is a region, I think the narrative we kept hearing, keep hearing now is that, you know, well, there's some sort of competition between China and Russia here. And, you know, this is something we always looked for. We always asked people about it. And we did certainly find a lot of paranoia from the Russian perspective. But the truth was, the two weren't really competitive in the same way, in the sense that Russia recognizes that what it has to offer in the region, a security guarantee, a kind of paternalistic view, a kind of sense of helping, you know, politics develop, was very different to the very transactional relationship that Beijing offered. And so this meant that while there was always this kind of funny competition, it was always a competition that actually the two were quite happy to get around, work around and deal with, in large part because from both Moscow and Beijing's perspective, the key issue at the moment is not Central Asia, but it is far more about the United States and the West and their greater confrontation with them. And in some ways, that means that they're going to overlook any small tensions that might exist between them in favor of making sure they stay on each other's side against the sort of West. And so I'll with that, maybe pull stumps and draw to a close, conscious I've strayed slightly over time, but I'll leave you with a beautiful cover, which we have of the book, which is a shot of the Khunjarab Pass, the border between Pakistan and China, which we got to visit a couple of times, which is, you know, the only final point I leave with you is that, you know, this book is in large part a travelogue based on a lot of travel around the region. And it's a region which I continue to find spectacular, continue to enjoy visiting, and would heartily encourage everyone to go visit, not only for the kind of geopolitics, which is fascinating, but also the natural beauty and frankly, the wonderful cultures that you can discover there. So I'll stop there, Professor Alden, and maybe pass it back to you. Thank you.
Great, thanks. Thanks very much. I think it really is a good note to end your comments there. And I'll pick up a few sort of summative points that I've drawn from this. One is that it's a longer standing relationship beyond the sort of historical. It's a longer standing relationship than people account for. The firing gun of it, as it were, was early on, this idea of looking westward. In fact, I do remember working in China and people talking about the westward orientation and they sort of repeated this. I was there thinking about China-Africa matters, so I always found it, you know, a little disconcerting, but obviously very, very true and very early as well, that this discourse was beginning. I think also the balance between the security and economic factors. And I think the idea, if I understood correctly from both what you've said and what the reading of the book, the idea that development is its own sort of set of security guarantees, which I think is a Chinese position. You want long-term security, you produce development, you generate conditions for development, and that its approach to the short-term contingencies of security questions really has a longer-term focus or emphasis in supporting that side of things. Something that I want to ask you is, insofar as we sometimes probably ahistorically, call this region or talk about the great game in this region. I'm just wondering if I can ask you where India fits in all of this, because of course the same countries and same borders touch, and there is that historical some of the same historical factors are at play, and of course they're in that odd position of skirmishes in the Himalayas, and then other sorts of diplomatic coherence or conformity, I should say, in other areas. So if I start with that.
Thank you. It's a really interesting question. And I think, you know, India is India is a funny one, because on the one hand, you know, India is a power that has tried repeatedly. And, you know, what you'll notice if you go back and look at sort of recent Indian leaders is one of the things they do, you know, when they come into power, and it doesn't seem to be a first thing, but something they definitely all do, is they do a big tour of Central Asia. And at the end of that tour, they say, India is now going to engage with this region. And this is I am the man who's going to lead this. You know, Manmohan Singh did this, Vajpayee did this before him, and more recently, Modi has done it as well. But then what immediately happens is nothing, you know, and it's kind of a story of frustrated expectations. The region is very keen and happy to engage with India. And actually, one of the interesting things we found is that Indian soft power was quite effective around the region. People like to watch, you know, Bollywood movies. They like Indian food. There's a connection that India does have that if it could cultivate, but it seems unable to sort of follow through on its initial kind of promise. Now, what ends up happening is we end up with the story of India being tied to the region in these very awkward ways, in the sense that on the one hand, they have the connection through the port of Chabahar in Iran, which gives you a kind of route across Iran into Central Asia, and therefore could give them access. But you have to go through Iran, a very heavily sanctioned country with the Americans. You have to go through Turkmenistan, which is a difficult country in itself. So it's always struggled with that. And then the other side, there's the famous Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India pipeline, which is one of these wonderful geopolitical concepts that people have been talking about for a long time, but really is very difficult foot to stand on. And so India is kind of hamstrung by being detached from the region. India has tried to engage with Central Asia. And in some ways, what they've done is try to present themselves competitors to China. But the truth is, they just can't compete. So I think on the Central Asian connection specifically, I think it's one that India has been frustrated, in part because of its own, I would argue, inability to follow through on initial promises, but also because of geographical realities. On the other side of the coin, to sort of look at maybe the borders aspect you touch on, which is the fact that, you know, while Xinjiang up to the north, you know, China up to the north looks to Central Asia, you know, down to the south, it looks to India. And there's a border there, you know, and then we go to Kashmir, you're really talking right at the kind of border of the two in some ways. You know, there it's a much more, you know, complicated relation. There India has ill-defined borders that has been fighting with China for a long time, and we saw erupt into violence recently a number of times. And then also then Pakistan becomes tied into this. And in many ways, I think China's articulation towards that border side very much leans towards Pakistan's views, and very much also leans to a kind of a superior view. And one of the things I've noticed in kind of other research is that, you know, the Chinese have a habit of looking a bit down on the Indians in this regard, and not really regarding them as a peer competitor, while the Indians see themselves very much as a peer competitor. And so there's kind of this mutual frustration and anger you get. But then on top of all of this, to add a sort of final level of complexity, which does really tie in Central Asia, is of course the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that has all of these countries as members. You know, all of the Central, well, not all of the Central, Turkmenistan is not a member, but, you know, China is, four of the Central Asians are, Russia are, and then of course India and Pakistan are. And what's interesting to me is, notwithstanding the deep border tensions you have between India and China, India still seems willing to engage with China in these international formats, like BRICS, like the RIC, the Russia-India-China grouping, or the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. I think that speaks to a bigger vision in some ways that I think China certainly has of itself as a dominant player across the entire Eurasian landmass, but also recognition from Delhi's perspective that actually they do need to try to play a game and can't just talk a game of hostility, which I think also then plays into the bigger geopolitical story that we all talk about when we tend to think about this region, which is, you know, the Quad and the idea of engagement with China through the Indo-Pacific, where we see India very much as an ally. And I think actually, when you get the Eurasian context and India within that context, you see a power that actually is far more ambivalent in its relationship towards China in some ways than it is maybe in the seas. That's maybe a more
grand answer than very interesting. I'm sort of picking up on that point. Jonathan Fenby, LSE associate, has asked a question, which is, it just got bumped out of my my inbox here. Okay, thank you for a very interesting presentation. Could you say something about the relations between the SCO Asian Central countries themselves and with China? Are there rivalries between them? Are they in step on their ambitions? And how does Beijing deal with their multinational nature?
Thank you. It's you know, Central Asian politics is wonderfully complicated. And I mean, one of the things that if you look at kind of World Bank or Asian Development Bank surveys of this region and sort of trade around it, one of the interesting phenomena is that actually if you look over time, and this may have changed recently, but it certainly hadn't, you know, when I last checked the numbers, transit across borders in some of these countries has gotten slower. You know, globally, if you look at transit across borders, it tends to speed up over time. People smooth over how, you know, processes and so on. But actually, in Central Asia, it's gotten slower because relations between these countries themselves are very negative. And this is always something we thought was going to cause a real problem for China, because, you know, China, when it was conceptualizing its BRI through this region, it was saying, well, we're going to build a road that starts in, you know, Urumqi and then sweeps through this region, goes to Russia or goes across the Caucasus, ultimately to get to Europe. But the problem is that, you know, the Kyrgyz and the Tajiks have a habit of shooting each other across their border and closing their borders quite frequently. The Kazakhs and the Kyrgyz, who are theoretically have open borders because they are both members of the Russian-led Eurasian Economic Union, you know, the Kazakhs and the Russians in particular get so worried about the flow of illicit goods across that border that they have closed those borders occasionally, even though, you know, this is like a European Union member closing its borders to another European Union member, something that would be unheard of in an EU context, right? But in the EAEU context, the Eurasian Economic Union context, it does sometimes seem to happen. They don't formally call it closing, but suddenly it becomes very difficult to get goods across the border. But the interesting thing from our perspective is that China never seemed to try to engage with these issues. They kind of said, well, you know, you need to resolve them. We're just here to do trade and we're just going to go across. And if there's a holdup across the borders, well, there's a holdup. That's the end of it. We're not going to try to do anything to address it. And maybe the kind of the most useful anecdote I'd offer to cast a light on this was when in about 2010 or 11, Kyrgyzstan was debating joining the Eurasian Economic Union. There was a big debate in Kyrgyzstan because they said, well, if we join this union, will that make trade with China suddenly more difficult and therefore less interesting and therefore less goods will transit across our border and therefore we'll lose out? And Kyrgyzstan is very dependent on these sorts of transit trade routes across its borders. They don't have many natural resources like some of the others. But when, you know, and of course, immediately the Chinese got wrapped into this debate and they didn't really want to express themselves. But at the time, the Chinese ambassador, a man called Wang Kaiwen, you know, finally, after much pressure, he did talk to the Kyrgyz press about this. And his answer was, look, we don't care. You know, our trade with Kyrgyzstan is a drop in the ocean. You know, it's a rounding error for China's global trade. It just doesn't matter. You guys work out what you want to do. We'll trade with you. That's the end of it. And I think that speaks to the bigger point, which is China just doesn't care. And this goes to the kind of inadvertent empire point, where you've got a power that is a really important economic partner to all of these countries, but it's not going to try to fix any problems. It's not going to try to get engaged. That kind of, you know, the old, you know, non-intervention policy or non, you know, continues to kind of hold in their kind of narrative. They don't want to get involved in dealing with these problems. They'll just let them deal, the locals deal with it, and we will kind of trade with everyone else. And that, I think, is actually going to be a real problem in Central Asia, where there still are deep tensions across borders between countries.
Thanks. Yeah, I was wondering, just to elaborate upon that, the idea of the degree to which these things are rivalries between authoritarian leaders as opposed to societies and what have you. And sometimes they fan that dimension.
But I won't point fingers, but you're entirely right. Within Central Asia, there are some leaders who do not like each other at a very personal level. Mm-hmm. And that in the past has been the foundation of these problems.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. And then Lee Jones from Queen Mary's has asked, could you please say more about the internationalizations of the PAP? What sort of activities are they involved in and why? Is this coordinated by the Chinese MFA at all or managed by the MPS or CMC, the military commission? And what are the consequences of PAP internationalization?
It's a very interesting and technical question, which I've thought a lot about. So I think the key thing in some ways I would articulate about the PAP and its engagement in the region is that what it says to me is that China's security concerns in this region are domestic ones. These are not international security concerns. So this is not a case of the PLA deploying abroad to kind of take over a part of the world or, you know, articulate an expansion of Chinese power. This is about domestic security concerns that are happening next door, and therefore the security force that deals with them at home needs to deal with them abroad. And so that's kind of the light that I see this within. What actually they look like in practice? Well, it's a lot of joint training exercises. If you look, it's the PAP that's done a lot of the kind of bilateral trainings with the Kazakhs, the Uzbeks, the Kyrgyz, the Tajiks, the Turkmen. It's very difficult to ascertain what's going on there. But to anyone who knows the region, that's a very, very close country, which is hard to ever really know what's going on in. But, you know, it's the PAP that built the border bases with along the Tajik-Afghan border. They invested in those there. And they're also the ones, I think, who are investing in engaging with the Afghans on the other side of the border. So it's really about China seeing its security concerns in this part of the world as an extension of domestic security concerns. How much is this coordinated with the MFA, with the PLA? It's a good question. It's very difficult to know. I must say I never found MFA counterparts I engaged with surprised by these, or officials I would talk to. They would always see it as kind of natural and they weren't ever very surprised by it. I would say the PLA, I think at a certain point, did start to feel a little left out from this story. And I think that's why I think you saw in 2016, they created this thing called the Quadrilateral Coordination Cooperation Mechanism, the QCCM, that brought together the chiefs of army staff of China, Tajikistan, Pakistan, and Afghanistan, which is kind of the four you have grouped around the Wuhan corridor, which is China's direct border with Afghanistan. And my understanding was the creation of that was in large part the PLA trying to get into the story, because until then, the story of security engagement with the region had been dominated by intelligence and the PAP.
Good, thanks very much. I have another question from Lucas Fiala. How might the Ukraine situation impact China-Russian relations and therefore affect China's standing in the region, Central Asia?
This is a difficult one. I said there's two levels to this. I think on the one level, I think that we have to realize that the China-Russia relationship is founded on an adversary relationship with the West. And I think as long as that adversary relationship remains, they will remain close, because why would China want to now throw Russia under a bus? Even if it does that, it's not going to soften the Western push against China. So what's the benefit from Beijing's perspective? You know, it's not like the West has said, oh, we're going to line up on you if you help us out with Russia. You know, the West said, you should help us out with Russia because there's a moral stain on your, you know, consciences if you don't. And, you know, I think China's a bit more depressingly realist than that. And so I think their view would be, well, you know, the Russia relationship is more important. This is a P5 member. It's still an important economy, important military power. They remain an important ally in our bigger confrontation with the United States. That's more important in some ways than whatever happens in Ukraine. And anyway, Ukraine's on the other side of the world. Within Central Asia, this echoes in a curious way. And what I would say to you is I would say go back and look at Georgia in 2008, when Russia first did this kind of game of, you know, recognizing breakaway republics and then saying that they were going in to invade to protect Russian-speaking peoples. You know, what's interesting about 2008 was actually Russia was quite condemnatory, was quite condemnatory of what Russia was doing at the time. And at the time, the Central Asians were very worried about it as well, because they thought, oh my God, you know, the Russians could do this to us, and the Kazakhs in particular. And, you know, more generally, they didn't, you know, they did particularly, they were worried about this. And the idea of redrawing borders on the basis of ethnicity is something that really worries people in the region and worry China. And at the time, actually, China was quite in the SCO format, then Prime Minister Medvedev actually came and lobbied the SCO to make a statement about Georgia, and the Chinese, under Hu Jintao, actively pushed back on this and stopped. And this was something the Central Asians very much appreciated. If we then flip forward to 2014, we can see that when the Russians went into Crimea, again, the Central Asians were concerned, but didn't really want to say anything because they're always worried about what Russia might think. But on the other hand, the Chinese kind of avoided saying anything as well, but they also didn't condemn, and they were kind of tacitly supportive in a way. To cut forward to today, where the Central Asians are as worried as they've been in the past, and the Kazakhs and the Uzbeks in particular have actually been quite vocal about their concerns, which is important to remember with the Kazakhs in particular, because, you know, in January of this year, they were asking the Russians to come and help them because of their own domestic instability. So, you know, it's a very important relationship, the one they have with Russia, for them to turn against the Russians like this, when the Russians are really pushing for everyone to be on side, is quite a big thing for them. But the Chinese are nowhere to be seen in this regard. They have avoided the discussion in Central Asia. They've engaged with the Russians, shown open support and continued support for the Russians. They have also showed support for the Ukrainians and tried to engage with the Ukrainians, but they're really not condemning the Russians in any sort of way. And so the narrative, I would say, is a changing one, you know, where I think at the geopolitical level, clearly China, Russia are not going to shift. At the regional level, I think China was more willing to be openly supportive in the past than it seems to be now. And I think that's going to have an interesting erosion in some way, I think, on China-Central Asia relations going forward. So it's certainly not something that anyone's looking at or focusing on at the moment.
Yes, I think very, very interesting. And just perhaps reflecting from the experience in Africa, the economic exposure and the pressure from African states, China's economic exposure and the pressure from African states continued to build in these multilateral fora that were created, in this case, in the FOCAC in Africa, perhaps the SCO as well. Members say, you know, what's this about? We need you to stepped up to the plate and manage a particular issue actively, not passively through stepping back from this every time something erupts. There's a question from Stephanie Mitchell, formerly of the Secretariat of the European Parliament's delegation for China and India. And she's asking, let me read it, because what's the view, as seen through the lens of the man in Central Asia, where common culture, halal needs, etc., mean that both Malaysia and Turkey sell a wide variety of consumer goods. It's striking that these items are much more prevalent in markets than Chinese goods or similar types, at least visually. How do these two countries react to developments you've described, as they see, and how do they see China's role? So I don't know if you have something to say on those particular countries and their responses to both, I suppose, as business entity, you know, commercial actors, but also in a broader social sense.
So Stephanie's asked a very interesting set of questions. I'll maybe
pick up. There's another question too. I mean,
there is, yeah.
If you'd like, reading. We can. Should I just carry on with that, or is that,
yeah? Well, why not try them both? At the same
pragmatic
time.
Observer,
well.
Yeah. Pragmatic observer might think that China would do well to use common language and cultural ties across the region through its own minorities. It's quite the opposite, as the Xinjiang example might suggest. So you know, what do you see China as? Why they haven't applied it, and what the exit strategy from this kind of conflict inspired view would be.
So I think that, so I'll start with the second one actually, because it's a useful way. And I think, and the interesting thing about the second one is actually, if you go back and look at China's relations with Central Asia in the 90s, actually at the time they were talking about using Uyghurs as their kind of key into the region. You know, there was a sense of actually flows going that way, and actually the Uyghur communities and the Central Asian communities that exist in China being a useful interlocutor that way. And so, you know, and then of course you've got Dungun communities, which are essentially ethnic Chinese in Central Asia, you know, who kind of offer an alternative on the other side. So initially, actually, China saw these as a useful key into the region. I think what's changed over time is the degree of which they're concerned about these communities creating separate entities and communities at home, and how much that then becomes something which, you know, the state has to worry about because it's losing control of something. So I think that's kind of flipped sadly on its head. But actually, as I say, you go back and look at in the 90s, it seemed to be more China using the communities in the positive light that I think Stephanie is referring to as kind of a key into the region. In terms of looking at some of the others, you know, in the region, you know, I think that the Malays and the Turks that you refer to specifically, I mean, they are present in the markets, and the Turks certainly are very present, more, I think, than the Malays, to be honest with you. But I think what's interesting about the Turks is the Turks, I think, stumbled in some ways because they took such a paternalistic attitude towards the region that was similar in some ways to the Russian one. So if you go back and look at sort of the 1990s again, at the sort of post-Cold War period, there was a push by the Turkish government at the time under, I think it was Turgut Özal, to expand the kind of Turkic-speaking world and Turkey to become the king of this larger region. And they saw Central Asia very much as part of that. Of course, you know, four of the Central Asian countries, Tajikistan is the exception, are Turkic peoples. But there's a difference between Turks and Central Asians, a linguistic difference, which is key. One of the funniest anecdotes I remember was we went to the, or one of the funny, one of many funny stories we have is when we were in Ashgabat, in Turkmenistan. We got into the Turkish embassy there and we were talking to them about this. And, well, you know, because in Turkmenistan in particular, they have visa-free passage with Turkey. And so there's lots of back and forth. And there's some very big Turkish companies that are very important there in construction in particular. And we asked, you know, the embassy were like, so, you know, is it true that, you know, Turkish and you know, Turkmen are identical? And the guy said, well, you know, they're close. And he goes, but one of the biggest things they found at the embassy was that they would frequently get called by Turkish businessmen who had come to Turkmenistan, assuming that they would be able to communicate to the locals in their language with great ease. But then lo and behold, you know, when they actually got to the meeting to discuss the term, suddenly the language failed them. And so they'd have to urgently call the embassy to get the embassy to send a diplomat to help translate. And he was like, this constantly happens to us. And, you know, and so the point being that these guys are close, but they're not that close. And, you know, I think the Turks have always not quite been able to deliver in some ways the same kind of economic investment that frankly you get from China. And so that's why I think the Turks have always kind of stumbled. The Malays have done some investment across the region, and you're right on the sort of halal food side in particular. But again, it's, you know, there's up to a point, you know, how far they can kind of go, and the opportunities and the companies are nowhere near of a capability and scale to frankly the Chinese or even the Russian one. So, you know, they're always present in these countries, but they're always kind of an alternate rather than a dominant one. So I think hopefully covers that. I think, you know, though to be fair, we drove along Turkish built roads across the region, and Malay energy companies, Petronas, has been one of the few that's been able to penetrate the Turkmen market, in contrast to some of the others that have tried in Turkmenistan. So, you know, I'm not going to say they haven't got a footprint, but it's one they like to play up. And frankly, on the ground, our experience was that actually it was very much more a story of China or Russia or even actually Western companies, frankly.
Great. We've got two more questions and we are going to run out of time. So I'm going to fire these questions off to you. Hopefully you'll give one-word answers. Perhaps
I'll be compact.
Exactly. One of them is from Hugo Jones. It seems that the moment has passed for China to intervene to support the Afghan economy. Will China maintain this hands-off approach, which I guess is in keeping with how you've described some of the other Central Asia approaches to Central Asian problems or issues? The other is Barak Tabanbayev, a research fellow in Fudan University and in Kazakhstan as well. Thank you for your presentation. My question, do you think Russia-Ukraine conflict will affect China's Belt and Road Initiative in Central Asia?
So, I mean, I think I'll start with the BRI one, because I think the thing about BRI is we get hooked on it thinking it's a project. It's not, it's a vision, it's a concept. It's a concept that President Xi has inserted into the party constitution. So BRI is not going to go away. It's going to continue. It has continued and it will. I think it'll just, the goalposts will move. I think that's frankly it. And I think you're entirely right to ask about BRI within the context of Ukraine, because Ukraine was a very important country in kind of BRI. If we think about all the maps and the routes, it was very important in that regard. Clearly, it's going to be a very different place going forwards. But I think the point I would add about that is not only BRI will continue because they'll just kind of shift the goalposts and move forwards in Central Asia or anywhere else, but two, I think it's interesting to observe how the Ukrainians have continued to not condemn China in the same way that they condemned other powers that have chosen to support the Russians on the world stage. Because I think the Ukrainians recognize that China is an important economic partner, and it was before the invasion, and it will probably be afterwards, no matter who ends up in charge. So I think that, to me, suggests that in some ways they will be able to pick up on BRI and other issues pretty smoothly at the end of the conflict that we're seeing, the horrible war that we're seeing in Ukraine at the moment. And then on the question about Afghanistan, I think, you know, what's interesting to me about the Chinese economic investment in Afghanistan is they've hedged for a very long time. But what's interesting now is that they're continuing to hedge, but in a way that's letting a lot of stuff happen back and forth. But the important thing I point about the investment that's happened in the Afghan economy from China is that it's all very low level, and that it's nothing that the state has really committed to. And I think, frankly, they're going to go forwards like that because, you know, at the end of the day, it's big Chinese companies that are going to deliver the game-changing projects in Afghanistan. And they won contracts with the Republic government that they didn't deliver on. I see very little reason why they're going to suddenly decide to deliver on these projects with a government in power that's less stable, frankly, than the government that came before, and less technocratic and less able to manage these things. So, you know, I don't want to discount it's going to happen. Eventually it could. But I think at the moment, the situation is a bit precarious. And I think Beijing is not going to commit to sending its state-owned enterprises to really invest and put effort into this country that could suddenly all go horribly wrong and leave them in a situation, of real precarity. So I think they're going to continue to hedge, frankly, in Afghanistan. And I think the interesting for me is how much that hedge has continued from before. The positive I would add is the Chinese are putting a lot more on humanitarian investment into Afghanistan, which is, I think, a very good thing and something that should be encouraged and applauded. I think it's a shame, though, that they're not following through on their economic investments as much as they could.
Great. I think we've run out of time, but not out of questions. And I would like to conclude by both thanking you, Raffaello, and also encourage people to buy this book and read this book. It's a kind of gallop through a wonderful, easy way to gallop through complexity and understand at the end of the day some very important changes happening in a region that we tend to neglect. So it's really a wonderful tribute to the work that you and your colleague did to produce this. So
thank you.
Thanks once again, and we'll see you at the next LSE. See everyone at the next China Foresight LSE Ideas event. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you so much. Thank you.